the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, July 27th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The politics of arms trafficking across the border. Celebrated filmmaker Haskell Wexler on the release of the director's cut of his 1985 film Latino, and what the closing of Borders Books means for indie bookstores, plus the activist beat with Rose Aguilar.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The House Government Oversight and Reform Committee held a hearing yesterday, hammering officials from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF for short, about the growing scandal over Operation Fast and Furious. An estimated 1,000 firearms were trafficked to Mexican drug cartels under the watch of the ATF as part of a failed anti-gun trafficking program. Firearms trafficked under Fast and Furious have been found at multiple bloody sites. Last December, a gun traced back to Fast and Furious was found at the scene of a gun battle where U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was killed. Yesterday, William Newell, former special agent in charge of the Phoenix ATF office, testified, quote, "It was not the purpose of the investigation to permit the transportation of firearms into Mexico." ATF officials acknowledged their goal was to track U.S. guns trafficked by low-level so-called straw buyers to leaders of Mexican cartels. At issue is whether ATF agents allowed guns to be, quote, walked across the border to then disappear into cartel weapon caches. ATF whistleblower and Mexico City attaché Jose Canino says he repeatedly warned his colleagues that the program had backfired, arming cartels instead of disrupting them. Canino eventually blew the whistle to Mexican Attorney General Marcela Morales. The Oversight Committee is also digging deep into how much the Department of Justice knew about the ATF's operations and how close the information came to the White House. The DOJ has denied any wrongdoing. In the word of one Republican congressman, both sides of the aisle and the American people are furious. However, the investigation is spearheaded by GOP Committee Chairman Daryl Issa, who vowed to overwhelm the Obama administration with investigations after his party regained control of the House earlier this year. Politico reports the ATF has also been a target of the National Rifle Association, or NRA, which has played a major role in keeping the agency without a permanent director since 2006. Joining me on the line this morning is Ted Lewis. He's the Human Rights and Mexico Program Director at Global Exchange. Welcome to Uprising, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, explain for our listeners, before we get into the congressional hearings yesterday, what exactly is the role of the ATF government agency? What is it supposed to be doing?
Well, the ATF is supposed to be keeping track of firearms and limiting the access of criminals to firearms. The ATF, however, is hampered by the fact that the NRA and their allies over the years have passed gun laws that make it virtually impossible to do that on a systematic basis. The real scandal here, and I'm not saying that Fast and Furious isn't a terrible blunder, and kind of an idiotic blunder by the ATF and the Obama administration. However, a far larger number of guns is flowing to Mexico every day as a result of weak laws on assault weapons and just routine practices that the same Republicans who are going after Obama so furiously on this particular issue aren't even don't seem to be concerned about. They're certainly not talking about it, and the number of guns that have gone across the border to Mexico under Fast and Furious is ridiculously high, but it pales in comparison to the number of guns that are being transited there just through the hundreds of gun stores, the dozens of gun stores in border areas that allows multiple purchases of assault weapons by these exact straw buyers that you referred to in your intro.
And that's because of lax gun laws that Republicans and the NRA fight to keep very, very loose.
Exactly.
Well, let's try to get the specifics of Fast and Furious. This was supposed to be a program that members of staff from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF for short, were supposed to be trying to track arms going into Mexico. But in the course of that, it was found that they essentially made available arms and then lost track of them.
Right.
Instead of keeping track of them, they ended up trafficking the arms themselves.
Apparently, what the ATF did was look at the situation of guns going to Mexico. And there has been a fair amount of pressure on the Obama administration, in particular from the Mexican government itself, to do something about the kind of unrestricted entrance of guns that are fueling the drug war in Mexico. I mean, we're talking about an almost unlimited supply of high-caliber weapons and very little control on the U.S. side of the sales of those. So the ATF was looking at these so-called straw buyers who come and purchase, one, two, five more guns at various gun stores and are able to then kind of repackage and sell those to drug traffickers, or they're people who are actually sent by the drug traffickers themselves to make those purchases. They started to think, well, there's not much we can do to stop these individuals from buying the guns, so let's track the weapons on in to Mexico and see if we can do a great big bust that will bring down some of the top cartel leaders.
So the idea was to follow the guns and have those lead to the top of the chain of command, or close to the top of the chain of command.
Right. I think they had dreams that they could bring down Chapo Guzman or one of the other top people in the cartels in this fashion. And instead, as you pointed out, what happened was that they really didn't have the resources, especially on the Mexican side of the border, to follow those guns. And so many of these guns simply, as Daryl Issa and the right-wingers who are pushing the investigation of this issue like to say, that these guns simply walked across the border and then disappeared into the chaos of the drug war. Certainly Mexican authorities were considered by the ATF to be unreliable to be partners in really following this operation, so they were left uninformed. So when the news of this began to leak out at the beginning of the year, people in Mexico were rightly furious. But what I think is very important in all this for your listeners to remember is that there's a much bigger question of gun trafficking,
right,
and poor laws that are behind this that are making the situation far worse and actually account for at least 20 times the number of guns annually that went through Fast and Furious.
And I want to get to that issue, but I want to play for you and our listeners an excerpt of the congressional hearing yesterday with Congressman Meehan, who was questioning staff from the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives.
Mr. Newell, the strategy Mr. McMahon identifies that you expect, you understand that he expects $70,000 worth of weapons. Where does that get in that there was no part in the strategy to allow guns to be taken to Mexico?
Yes, sir. We still, during the beginning parts of this case, we did not know who the Plaza boss was. We didn't know.
That's not my question about who the Plaza boss was. The question is there a Plaza boss? Agent McMahon just said he's in Mexico.
Right.
And the Plaza boss expects $70,000 worth of guns. Now you're saying no part of the strategy was allowed the guns going to Mexico. Who's right here?
Sir, the strategy wasn't to allow guns to go to Mexico.
But what did Agent McMahon just say?
Sir?
This was an OSADEF case.
Yes.
Who else participated in this in the form of this going up?
I'd ask unanimous consent the gentleman be allowed to have another 30 seconds. Thank you.
Sir.
Was this an OSADEF case?
Yes, sir, it was.
Okay, that implies that at a certain point in time it moves beyond your agency, does it not?
Yes, sir.
What does that mean with regard to OSADEF? What kind of other participants were there as part of OSADEF?
Well, there's other agencies that were involved in this.
Other agencies. Yep. What other agencies were involved in this?
In this investigation, they were full partners in this case, was Immigration and Customs Enforcement, now known as Homeland Security Investigations. We had Internal Revenue Service, and we had assistance to some level from DEA.
So are you saying DEA, IRS, and ICE all knew about this program to participate in the OSADEF?
They participated in the investigation, yes.
In the investigation. Were they aware that guns were being walked to Mexico?
Sir, again, I'm assuming that they were, I mean, I know they were aware of the strategy, but it's
they were aware of the strategy.
Yes, sir.
And that is an excerpt of the Times quite tense hearings that the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee held yesterday, questioning officials from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF, about their Fast and Furious program. They were referring to OSADEF, the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. My guest is Ted Lewis, Human Rights in Mexico Program Director at Global Exchange. Ted, from that exchange that we just heard, it sounds like Republicans, conservatives, are hoping that this particular controversy will help them point out that multiple agencies in the government were involved, were collaborating on this program. And do you see this as them looking for an opening to indict various levels of government?
Well, I think it could certainly lead to that. They in those same hearings, talked about needing to replace the agents or the officials who were involved in conducting this operation. And indeed, this is, you know, on its surface, a very scandalous event, because it involves a decision taken at high level to allow contraband, in this case in the form of weapons, to cross an international border. And what makes it worse is that there was no coordination with our Mexican, supposed counterparts in the drug war to make this happen. So it is very scandalous. It has caused tremendous outrage in Mexico. Again, the real question for me is, are these same people who are going after the ATF now really interested in stopping the gun flow to Mexico, or are they simply seeking to embarrass the Obama administration and create a political scandal? If I were in the Obama administration, I would be, you know, deeply embarrassed by this. And I think that this reflects the failure on the part of the Obama administration to do any kind of serious reevaluation of the entire drug war strategy in Mexico. And there are a number of ways that the United States fuels that conflict, the most obvious one being the creation of a gigantic illicit drug market through our, you know, policies of prohibition, which have clearly shown themselves to be failures. The other is joining Mexico in a failed military strategy, which has sought to replace local police who are deemed to be corrupt with federal police and army. This has led to drastically higher levels of violence, especially in places like Ciudad Juarez. And then the third aspect of the way that we are fueling this war is through our lax, criminally negligent, in my opinion, gun policies, which allow all these guns to go to criminals in the first place. Had the ATF not been there, those same purchasers would have been able to acquire these guns. It's not like the ATF encouraged them to do this. It's simply that they stood by while it happened and tried to track something so that they could make big busts later. This was a silly thing to do, because they didn't have the resources to conduct it.
On that issue of not having the resources, this is an agency that is, I understand, one of the few, if not the only agencies in the U.S. that does have the power or is charged with looking at arms trafficking across borders, but they are so poorly funded and staffed that it's not really realistic to imagine that they can do much. Why are they so poorly staffed and funded? Is that going back to the same reasons we talked earlier about lobbying from gun rights groups like the NRA and conservative organizations?
Yes, yeah, so there's been a concerted strategy, you know, since the 1970s to reduce the amount of resources that are available for the ATF and anyone who's you know doing oversight on weapon sales and investigations in the United States. The ATF is has its hands tied in innumerable ways, some of which were detailed in a New York Times series last year that came out before this scandal was, you know, unearthed, and it is such things as difficulties even with the computer databases and the being allowed to put weapons into computer databases. One of the weapons that have been used in crimes into computer databases. One of the reasons for that being that the gun industry, which has its voice through the NRA. Did not want crime victims to be able to make use computers and databases to make kind of class action suits against gun dealerships, where they could say, "Oh, not only were my loved ones hurt, but so was this whole other group." And without computer databases accessible, that kind of thing is very difficult. And those are specifically things that the NRA and its allies have pushed for to limit. So there's been a great deal of effort and opprobrium sent against these agencies. So, you know, the ATF is not my favorite agency in the government, but in fact, if asked, I would say that they need more authority, not less, to go after these kind of weapon sales. And the administration itself, rather than go for these kind of cat and mouse operations where they would have to rely on unreliable Mexican counterparts, they should do some of the things that they actually can do administratively to dampen the flow of weapons, such as an import ban on assault weapons, something that hasn't been done since the George H.W. Bush administration, but something that's in the power of the administration to do.
So you basically to address the issue of arms trafficking at their source, which is in the U.S.
Yes, because and one of the ways without changing the basic gun laws, one of the things that the administration could do is cut off a very significant flow of weapons that come into the country. The weapons that are the weapons of choice for many of the cartels. And let's remember that the principal source of weapons for the cartels, don't be confused about this, is American, you know, legally sold weapons in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is far outnumbers the guns that come from any other source. Despite what you might read on the internet, that's just the case. Many of the weapons that do flow through American gun dealers come from Eastern Europe, come from other places. Those are the places where the kind of AK-47, the you know the gun that many people have become familiar with through guerrilla wars and that sort of thing. It was a Soviet weapon originally. Many of those pistol grip AK-47 type guns and those sorts of weapons that are particular favorites of the cartels just come into the country legally and then go to these gun stores and are resold, you know, into the hands of people who ship them into the...
So the Obama administration could do much by simply banning even that one type of weapon. Well, Ted Lewis, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Give out a website for your organization, Global Exchange.
Our organization is www.globalexchange.org.
That's globalexchange.org. We'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org. Thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted Lewis is the Human Rights in Mexico Program Director at Global Exchange. This is Uprising, and after this short break, Haskell Wexler joins us in studio to discuss the director's cut release of his 1985 film Latino, and we'll also hear this week's edition of The Activist Beat with Rose Aguilar. Finally, near the end of our program, we'll take a look at what the closure of Borders Books means for independent bookstores. Stay tuned.
Technique, I'm like your soul, nigga, indispensable. indispensable, with no respect for those who cower at the hour of revolution, because the government owes my people restitution instead of sedatives like cocaine and prostitution. Conclusion is that you'll have to violently silence me, because I raid the airwaves at cutthroat piracy. In school, my teachers blinded me, but now I can see. Now I'm mentally and revolutionarily free, broadening horizons about what my people could be if we wasn't set up.
Immortal
to get shot,
technique with Speak Your Mind here on Uprising. Immortal Technique will be joining Muse, Lauryn Hill, El Gran Silencio, and Rage Against the Machine for a concert this Saturday, July 30th at 3 p.m. at the L.A. Coliseum. We have two pairs of tickets to give to the first two callers who can answer the following question correctly. In what city was Immortal Technique born? The first two callers who can answer correctly which city he was born in at 818-985-5735 will win a pair of tickets to the L.A. Rising concert. That's 818-985-KPFK.
Man of any complexion with a devilish nature, because I'm trying to save the earth, but you're just getting in line to rape her.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In 1985, celebrated filmmaker Haskell Wexler released his feature film on the secret U.S. war in Nicaragua called simply Latino. The film's plot was centered around a character named Eddie Guerrero, played by Robert Beltran, who ends his tour of duty in the Vietnam War only to find himself in Central America training U.S.-backed counter-revolutionaries, or Contras. The film dramatized one of various covert American efforts to destabilize Latin American governments at the time. While Latino didn't result in a box office hit for Wexler, it typified the kind of work the Hollywood veteran became known for in challenging conventional wisdom, particularly the impacts of U.S. militarism. Latino was chosen to screen at the 1985 Cannes Film Festival, where it won a prestigious award. More than a quarter of a century after its original release, Haskell Wexler has released just now the director's cut of Latino on DVD, distributed by Cinema Libre. I spoke recently with the multiple Academy Award winner about the film and his work. Haskell Wexler is best known for his groundbreaking films in the 60s and 70s, such as Medium Cool, which he directed, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, In the Heat of the Night, Bound for Glory, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Coming Home, which he was the cinematographer for. He's also made a number of documentaries about issues like the Vietnam War, Chile, the School of the Americas, Nicaragua, and more. He made the film Latino with the help of his mother, as well as George Lucas, and through his own personal funds. The film was produced by Benjamin Berg. Welcome to Uprising, Haskell Wexler.
Thank you, Somali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So your film, Latino, America's Secret War on Nicaragua, the director's cut is just released, but this is a historic film, a film that you have been, you won an award for, major award for, and it was one of your earlier films. Tell us about how how you came to make this film. It's not a documentary. It's a feature film. And you dramatized the U.S. role in Nicaragua through the story of one man. How did that story come to you?
Well, the dramatic film grew out of a documentary that Saul and I made.
Saul Lando.
Called Target Nicaragua. And we were in Nicaragua shortly after the Somoza the dictator was kicked out, and we discovered that there was a secret war going on where we were supporting mercenaries called Contras, and so we shot this documentary Target Nicaragua, and from that came my thought to make a dramatic film which I believe people would respond to more than coming out with the documentary, which would probably die because the war was secret. There was no military activity as far as the media here. So,
Eddie Guerrero, who is the main protagonist of the film, he's an ex-Vietnam vet who stayed on in the military and essentially goes to help train the Contras for the United States. But then he has a personal connection. And I suppose at the heart of any feature film that wants to tug at human emotions is a love story.
Well, Robert Beltran plays the character of Eddie Guerrero, And he comes from East L.A., from a Spanish-American Latino family, and truly patriotic in the sense of the world, that he was a proud soldier. And he was sent down to help the Contras. And he realized that his activities had to be secret. And he didn't like that idea of going in what they call sterile. And that's sort of demonstrated in the film. And, of course, he gets mixed up with a Nicaraguan woman who's living in Honduras. You know, it's got to have a movie. You got to have a little love life. But it did sort of reveal certain things to him.
Now, the film captures one aspect of a sordid U.S. military history in Latin America that didn't just target Nicaragua, although in Nicaragua with the Contras, it was quite dramatic and a very direct U.S. connection. But the U.S. has a sordid history throughout Latin America in the 1980s. At the time you were making this film, how much was known? What was the political context here in the U.S.? And how was your film received?
The film was pretty much ignored when it was brought in. In the Washington Post, Krautheimer, when it was showed in Washington, opened in Washington, and they said that it was ill-conceived. I don't know, other derogatory terms, and had nothing to do with reality, but.
And it showed at Cannes, didn't it, in 1985?
Yes, it won all due regard at the Cannes Film Festival. Of course, the Europeans were more aware of what was happening. But then it broke, the Iran-Contra affair broke, which showed that the U.S. government was getting money to Iran and using that money to help the Contras. And that sort of blew the cover. And Ronald Reagan referred to the war, that the terrorist war that the Contras are doing, is the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. And in the director's cut, we also included at the beginning where Ronald Reagan says that we will fight terrorism from Nicaragua to Afghanistan.
Very prescient. Now, in the creation of this director's cut, how does it differ from the original film?
Mostly setting it in the context of the times and how the media has deceived the American people into just thinking that we're always the good guys, and if we're doing terrorist acts, they aren't really terrorist acts. We are killing for a good cause, and killing for a good cause terrorist acts, because you understand what the Contras did is they went in there and targeted farmers, educators, actually priests who worked with the people. To destroy the fabric of a newly elected government, which had good intentions. It had plenty of problems, but it had good intentions for the people. And so I think that having the director's cut coming out now is to try to break the veil of this idea that terrorism or terrorists are just what the violence that other people do. Just like in movies, we have good guys and bad guys, and good guys can do bad things, and sometimes they do it for the good of the bad people.
I'm speaking with celebrated filmmaker, cinematographer, film producer, and director Haskell Wexler. And we're talking about the director's cut of his film, Latino America's Secret War in Nicaragua. The film was originally released in the 1980s. It's a feature film about the U.S. training of the Contras in Nicaragua. Now, you've made both feature films and documentaries, many, many films. And it seems as though in the last decade or so has been the sort of decade of the documentary. American audiences have seemed to be more receptive to documentaries with Michael Moore's films, you know, making it into theaters and documentaries getting theatrical releases. Is the feature film and the documentary, are these two both very sort of separate and different ways of telling a story via film to an audience? Is one better than another at relating information?
I have a theory called Life the Movie. It's all fiction, in a sense. It's all the presentation of ideas, drama. And, you know, when you see someone speak, you should be able to imagine from behind the teleprompters and realize that the things that they're reading, some writers worked on, what they say is something conceived to evoke certain emotions and certain ideas, and to do it as interestingly as possible, and certainly overtly fiction things can get people's imagination, their senses, quicker than just factual or so-called factual things. And, of course, the factual things are always, when you hear someone, the percentage of this people believe this and the percentage, you wonder who's taking these censuses and who and what questions they're asking them. So that I think it's both in overtly fiction and documentary, we have to say, what's more important, human beings or profit and power? And that's what we're dealing with today.
One of the, going back to your film, Latino, an important theme in the film is the fact that there are, you know, there's a substantial Latino population here in the United States, and it brings to light the military recruitment. It sort of, you know, made me think of the military recruitment, particularly of people of color and young people of color, Latinos, that is, that has been going on and that still goes on today. It was interesting to me how you brought together these two threads, the U.S. role in Latin America and then Latino Americans in the United States and their relationship to the military. Today, there's a lot of discussion about the undocumented immigrant population. And some young people are pushing the DREAM Act, which would give people citizenship through military service. So it seems as though a lot of the themes that you highlight in this film, with us, you know, being involved in Afghanistan and Iraq today, so many of these themes are relevant today. Over your long career as a filmmaker and a political activist, does it make you cynical to see so many of these issues so dominating today's political discourse and that it doesn't seem as though much has changed?
Well, to think of being patriotic is expressed through being a better killer is not what in Latino, for example, when Eddie Guerrero sees that he's killing people who look like his brother, when the film begins and his mother is making tortillas for them before they leave L.A. and so forth, he breaks the veil. The military teaches people that the enemy is not really a whole person. They're the enemy per se, and you can kill the enemy. But when he realizes, particularly in Latin Americans and someone of Latin American descent, it's clear that that they're not the enemy, And the military has to inculcate that kind of insensitivity in order to have an effective military. And they and Latinos were recruited for work in Latin America, and also because they represent a big section of the poorer people who go to the military.
Do you hope, finally, that this time around, you mentioned earlier that your film, when it was first released, was ignored in the mainstream. It's now going to be, the director's cut is going to be available on DVD. Do you hope that it'll get a wider audience and a greater awareness of our history in Nicaragua?
I hope so. I hope that, and there's going to have Spanish subtitles, which the original didn't have. And you were interviewing Saul earlier.
Saul Lando,
whom I've worked with, and I mentioned the beginnings of Latino came from working with Saul Lando, and dealing with the idea of terrorism. And now we talk about the war on terrorism. So this is an abstraction because it's an ism. And as long as we have these enemies that are invisible and are ideological, we can be led to kill each other, and that's not right, and that's not human.
Haskell Wexler, what are you working on these days?
I just came out shooting a film with Kevin McKiernan called "Bringing King to China." It's about his daughter and Kevin McKiernan, who is a war correspondent and writer, bringing ideas of nonviolence, Martin Luther King, through a dramatic story. So we shot in China and here in America, and trying to bring forward the ideas of nonviolence as a way for civilization to get out of this dead heap of violence and destruction and anti-humanism.
Well, Haskell Wexler, it's an honor to have you here on Uprising. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest is 89-year-old Haskell Wexler, the celebrated filmmaker, award-winning, best known for his groundbreaking films such as Medium Cool, which he directed, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, In the Heat of the Night, Bound for Glory, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Coming Home, which he was a cinematographer for. He's also made a number of documentaries, and we've just been discussing the release of the director's cut of his 1985 feature film, which he directed, called Latino, The Secret War in Nicaragua. You can watch the video of my interview with Haskell Wexler on uprisingradio.org later this morning. After this week's edition of The Activist Beat, we'll look at how independent bookstores may see a whole new landscape in the wake of the closure of Borders Books. Stay tuned.
Hola, ¿qué tal? I am Rubén Luengas, host of Contragolpe. Contragolpe airs every Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Tune in to hear a different perspective from the Spanish-speaking community. If you don't understand Spanish, don't worry, you can practice a little bit with me. I invite you to listen to my show, Contragolpe. Contragolpe.
Contragolpe. Credibility, facts, analysis, debate, and intense dialogue. Contragolpe, part of the new and exciting lineup, Wednesday nights.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW in San Francisco with this week's Activist Beat for Uprising. Each week, I'll bring you a weekly roundup of progressive activism that the mainstream media ignores, undercovers, or misrepresents. Environmental activists are ramping up their campaigns against the Keystone XL oil pipeline. This project has not received the attention it deserves. It's a $13 billion pipeline that would run almost 2,000 miles from the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, all all the way down to oil refineries in Texas. Over 900,000 barrels of tar sands a day would travel through Montana, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Now think about what a project of this scope would entail. Think about the damage it would do to the environment. John Stansbury, an environmental engineer at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says a rupture could release 7 million gallons of oil. A slow leak in a remote part of Montana could go undetected for weeks. Another pipeline made by the same company, TransCanada, has already had several spills. A recent New York Times editorial points out that the pipeline would have no effect on oil prices. This crucial piece of information is not in most articles. The editorial goes on to say that, quote, on the merits, economic and environmental, and in terms of future energy policy, this is the wrong pipeline for the wrong oil. A few weeks ago, more than 100 environmental activists from across the country occupied the office of Montana's Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer to demand he rescind his support for the pipeline. He met with the activists for nearly 20 minutes, but refused their demands. A number of environmentalists, including Bill McKibben and Maud Barlow, are asking concerned citizens to join them in Washington, D.C. on August 3rd. In an invitation, they write, quote, to call this project a horror is a serious understatement. The tar sands have wrecked huge parts of Alberta, disrupting ways of life in indigenous communities. The pipeline crosses crucial areas like the Iglala Aquifer, where a spill would be disastrous. And though the pipeline companies insist they are using state-of-the-art technologies that should leak only once every 7 years, the precursor pipeline and its pumping stations have leaked a dozen times in the past year. These local impacts alone would be cause enough to block such a plan. McKibben, Barlow, and the others say this will not be a one-day action. They'll stay for weeks, as long as it takes for the administration to halt the plan. Now, because the pipeline would cross the U.S. border, it has to be approved by the State Department. And that means Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has the power to derail the project. But her former deputy campaign manager, Paul Elliott, is now a lobbyist for TransCanada, the sole owner of the pipeline. And therein lies the problem. Once again, big oil and lobbyists are clearly calling the shots. There's no other way to explain this. The pipeline makes no sense. This will do nothing to minimize this country's addiction to oil or to reduce greenhouse gases. The administration's plan for a, quote, energy independent future is nothing more than empty rhetoric. We all need to take action on this before it's too late. The State Department is planning to issue its final environmental review next month. The EPA has told the State Department that both of its drafts thus far have been inadequate. The State Department is also expected to have public meetings in the six states that will be affected. They're still being planned. A final decision must be made by November 1st. So spread the word on this. Once the pipeline is approved, there's no going back. I'm Rose Aguilar for Uprising.
Thanks, Rose. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. A last-minute bid by Borders Group, Inc. to sell 30 of its bookstores and assets to Books A Million has failed. Borders Books, the nation's second-largest bookseller now, faces the liquidation of its nearly 400 stores nationwide. Internationally, Borders operates more than 500 stores. The giant retailer announced Title 11 bankruptcy in February of this year. The fall of Borders raises questions about the future of print books and the physical stores that sell them. The growing popularity of digital books and the expansion of online retailers like Amazon.com has made print and digital books almost instantly available to consumers through a few clicks online. What does this mean for independent booksellers? On the one hand, the imminent absence of a Borders store in a city can drive more business to existing independent bookstores. But on the other hand, publishers, who are owed millions of dollars by the bankrupt chain, are likely to pressure indie bookstores to pay up their bills faster. Additionally, the same factors that potentially led to Borders closing can impact independent booksellers. Here in Southern California, independent bookstores are a near extinct breed, with beloved institutions like Midnight Special Books in Santa Monica having closed their shutters one after another over the past several years. One indie bookstore that has managed to survive for more than 100 years is Romans Books in Pasadena. Allison Keyes is the assistant promotional director at Romans Bookstore. She joins me on the phone now. Welcome to Uprising, Allison.
Good morning.
And also with us on the phone is Andy Lates. He is the author of Rebel Bookseller, How to Improvise Your Own Indie Store and Beat Back the Chains. He wrote the book about 6 years ago. It's just out now in its second edition with a much longer subtitle. Welcome to Uprising, Andy.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So first, Allison, let me ask you, how do you explain why Borders has closed down? Why was this mega chain not able to survive?
Well, I think it's no secret that, you know, Borders expanded rapidly and opened several stores too quickly. A lot of articles that I've read about the subject discussed, you know, that they had long-term leases and those became difficult to maintain once the DVD and music industries took a hit. Also, you know, they didn't really, they lacked the ability to try and act quickly on making profit off of their internet sales and e-books. They came in late to that market.
Well, since Romans has been around for so long, your bookstore has the history that enables us to ask the question, what did the advent of mega chains like Borders and Barnes & Nobles and online sellers like Amazon.com, how did it change Romans' ability to sell books?
You know, definitely more competition and, you know, more people taking a cut of the market, really. Borders, you know, was definitely our main competition along with Barnes & Noble in the beginning, but definitely as the years have gone on, we've all kind of appeared to stand side by side against Amazon. So,
well, Andy Lates, in one of the pieces that you've written about this story, I was shocked by the statistic that 2/3 of indie bookstores in the United States closed down during the 1990s. A portion of the, you know, the third that survived have remained fairly strong, or they've simply, you know, been replaced by newer ones. Did these bookstores, 2/3 of these bookstores, did they close down because of big chains like Borders?
Well, you have to keep in mind that the independent bookselling channel is extremely flexible, so that we've seen over the last 50 years, we've seen the number of independent booksellers as high as 10,000 and as low as 1,500. And right now it's near its low. It's about 1,500, and it's been there for about 10 years. But in the 1980s, we saw a huge growth in independent bookselling because of weakness in the chains of those that era. B. Dalton and Walden Books were quite weak, and that permitted independent bookselling to expand. The growth of the chains in the 1990s was essentially the turnover of the chain bookstores from the 80s into new chain bookstores of the 90s. And so independent bookstores dropped, but it is my feeling that when the chains decline in strength, that gives an opportunity for the independent channel to increase in strength. And this means more individuals stepping forward and saying, I think I'd like to try to open an independent bookstore. It's not so much about stores like Romans that have been fighting the fight for 100 years. It's about people who are either their authors, their librarians, their teachers, their lawyers. They're people who've always sort of dreamed in the back of their mind that maybe they should open an independent bookstore. This is an opportunity right now for those people to join with some of the experienced managers who are being laid off at Borders to come forward and say, let's try an independent bookstore in this community that pays very close attention, as Romans has been doing for 100 years. Let's try to do that ourselves right now. This is a great moment for them.
And I want to you to expand on that in just a moment. But Allison, how has Romans kept up with retailers like Amazon.com and also with the advent of digital e-books? I mean, yours is a store that is a physical location where people come in to browse physical books and walk out with them in hand. How have you managed to survive Kindles and Amazon.coms?
Well, our store is really more than just the products on the shelves. You know, we've been around for 116 years now, and we're part of a loyal community where generations have grown up coming to our store. You know, they grew up coming to our story time as children and then have brought their children. You know, we're part of a family tradition. You know, we have weekly story times. We have an extensive children's section, and we host over 400 events a year. So we really try to service the family and the community. With e-books, you know, that definitely has changed the market a bit, but we hope that, you know, what we provide to the community and to our customers, that they recognize that the value in browsing a bookstore and having a new book put in their hands and getting a new book that they may have never even realized that they would be interested in, that there is a world of books beyond their browsing history and related items they're shopping online.
Andy Leahy's, your book is called Rebel Bookseller, Why Indie Businesses Represent Everything You Want to Fight For, from Free Speech to Buying Local to Building Communities. So if you're saying that now is a really good time for people who've always wanted to open an independent bookstore to do so, to join with some of those laid off Borders managers, etc., what are some of the ways in which they can avoid past mistakes, either the mistakes of Borders or even the pitfalls that independent bookstores have faced in the past?
Well, an important mistake that Borders made was that they signed very, very long leases, for instance. And some of those leases were signed at what now look to be premium prices. But this is a moment when the price of and the value of real estate has been dropping, and there are empty storefronts all over this country, in some cases in shopping districts that are quite viable. Landlords are interested in cutting deals right now. And bookstores are understood to be the kind of business that will draw traffic and increase the value of surrounding properties. So the number one thing that someone who wants to open an independent bookstore should do right now is to try to find out what exactly the real estate situation is in terms of empty storefronts in your community. Find out who the property managers are, and see if you can cut a really good deal on a storefront. Maybe get it for free for 6 months or for a year, just to help to reinvigorate the local community. That's the first thing that you should do, is pay very close attention to the advantageous real estate moment.
And as an aside, Borders is going to be leaving behind these gigantic box stores, too big perhaps for independent bookstores to try to fill. But, you know, this is the sort of part of the Walmartization of America, where gigantic retailers create these massive box stores, leave behind a lot of independent institutions in the dust. And then when they shut down, they just leave these empty buildings behind.
In many cases, it was communities that gave tax incentives to those very companies to come in. Mm-hmm. In some cases, Borders was given millions of dollars in tax incentives and special allowances by communities that thought they were getting something that was permanent. We fought against this in the 1990s. I remember testifying in front of the Oak Park City Council in the mid-90s about this terrible mistake that these city councils made. And in many cases, these people, having been burned, are going to be wiser going forward into the future. And I think that they're going to really work together with aspiring entrepreneurs to put independent bookstores back into those communities. I think that some people have learned their lesson.
Allison Keyes, you're the Assistant Promotional Director at Vroman's Bookstore. And Vroman's has not just managed to survive 116 years, but also expanded. You have a second location. Do you think that the closure of Borders is going to be good for Vroman's? Or does one, you know, do you take the opinion that, well, if Borders can't survive, it might be even tougher for stores like Vroman's?
Well, I think, you know, it's always sad to see bookstores close in communities and see people lose their jobs. But, you know, we do hope to be able to become a new home for the displaced readers that leaves and maybe see a bit of increase in our sales. We did have Borders bookstores that were very close to each of our stores. And, it definitely did hurt. And we hope to be able to try and help those readers and show them, what Vroman's has to offer.
And tell our listeners briefly the kinds of things that an independent bookstore like Vroman's has to offer, because one imagines that Borders and Barnes & Noble's and these large bookstores are the only bookstores that offer, the cafe connected to the bookstore, a plush environment to hang out in and read books with your friends, a large book selection. Does Vroman's offer those same kinds of things?
Yeah, we also have a cafe. We have a large book selection. We also have a lot of gifts and a large greeting card selection as well. In addition to all of our events that we do weekly story time.
And you have author events, too.
We have author events frequently almost every night in the store. You know, we do local community events such as in-store book fairs and fundraisers, and do community events with, recently we did something with the Arroyo Food Co-op. So we try and be a part of the community and be a venue for their events as well.
So listeners who might miss their Borders store because that was the only option they had can certainly check out if they're in the area in Vroman's, near Vroman's in Pasadena, where Vroman's is located, can try to get a similar experience. Andy, ladies, what about this issue that Borders, because it owed millions of dollars to publishers, right, because bookstores have accounts with publishers and aren't always up to date, because it owed millions to publishers and is defaulting, is basically declaring bankruptcy, that now these publishers may turn around and try to call in all of the debts from independent bookstores to make up their losses, and that this hole that Borders is leaving behind may really financially impact existing bookstores.
Well, I think that for many, many years, the publishers have been utilizing their relationships with independent booksellers as a way to finance the troubles that they had managing their relationships with the chains.
So that was already an existing problem.
What's that?
It was already an existing problem, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. It was already an existing problem. Back in the early 90s, the American Booksellers Association actually sued five major publishers because of the way that they were giving away money to the chains. In advertising allowances, for instance, that were not equally and proportionally available to independent booksellers. So independent booksellers have been trying to control the behavior of the publishers, of the large publishers, for many years, and without much success. It's unquestionably true that the publishers, the large publishers, sometimes try to tighten the leash on independent bookstores, and they are generally more successful at tightening the leash on independents than they are on Borders. What's happening with Borders walking away from tens of millions of dollars of debt is an example of the publishers failing to keep Borders on a tight enough leash in the last 5 years when they were in significant trouble. The publishers would not be taking this loss if they had tried to hold Borders more accountable in the last 5 years. So, yes, you're right. Instead, it's going to be independent booksellers who are getting tighter credit, are having more difficulty obtaining books, but and you know, some of them that are on the edge are going to have to figure out additional and different strategies. For instance, many independent booksellers now are turning to consignment systems. I was signing at a bookstore just the other day that has a huge collection of zines, which are self-published art magazines, and those are generally sold on consignment. And additionally, I was at an event 2 days ago with St. Mark's Bookstore in New York, which has always had a large collection of consignment books that are self-published by artists on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. So there are opportunities to stock very good books on a consignment basis with self-published or small presses. And these are the kinds of things that independent bookstores can do to try to alleviate the problems when the big publishers essentially cut their own throats by causing trouble for the independent bookstores unfairly, troubles that were caused by the publisher's own failure to properly manage the chains in the past.
Andy, ladies, give out a website very briefly for your book.
www.rebelbookseller.com.
That's rebelbookseller.com, and I'm sure the copies of the books are likely to be available at bookstores like Vroman's. If not, you can probably order them through Vroman's. Allison Keyes, give out the address for Vroman's and a website as well.
We're at 695 East Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena, California, and our website is www.vromansbookstore.com.
And we'll link to those from our website later today. I want to thank the two of you, Allison and Andy, very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Uprising. And for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Henry Ford once said, "If money is your hope for independence, you will never have it. The only real security that a man will have in this world is a reserve of knowledge, experience, and ability." That's Henry Ford. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. And congratulations to our winners for the tickets to LA Rising concert. Peter and Eric from Los Angeles won the tickets. They answered correctly the question of where Immortal Technique was born. He was born in Lima, Peru. That's which city he was born in, Lima, Peru. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Komal Devjani is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.